sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
A big jobs blowout, and analysts are stunned. U.S. dollar is raging higher as bets on a Fed rate hike are renewed. Shake Shack reports a good quarter, but there's some questions. And congressional inquiries are rocking biotech and the pharma industry. All this and much more on episode number 437 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there, Andrew Horowitz here, and it is time for the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me. Of course, if you ever want to contact me, you could do so. Just send me a quick email at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can follow me over on Twitter, and I hope that you do because I think I put out some cool stuff every once in a while. Maybe some silly stuff too, but there's some good stuff I put out there over on Twitter. My handle, Andrew Horowitz. It's one word. You'll be able to follow me there. And, I had a busy weekend. I don't know about you, but I was at the boat show this weekend, the Fort Lauderdale International Boat Show. I think, I got some unbelievable stats about that. I'll tell you about that in a second. I was at the T3 conference down in Miami, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and did some fishing, which ended up in, I'll tell you something. There is such an incredible difference. If you know anything about boating down in, certain waters, I guess, especially in Florida, the difference between the summer waters and winter waters, or really the summer waters and anything else. Summer, it's flat, beautiful. You just go out there, you do your thing. Any time else, especially like now where there's some wind and, it was nasty out there. We got out there and I think it was about 3 to 5 foot seas easily. And we kind of set up. We did some kite fishing. We were going for sailfish and some kingfish, wahoo, and spent a good part of the first half hour trying to just set ourselves straight in terms of making sure that we weren't going to get tossed overboard, holding on to things, getting the kite set up. And then we spent the next half hour just watching for anything to hit, which it didn't. And then we spent the next 15 minutes trying to get this diver who just plopped himself in the water right in our drift. And we were like, what's going on here? Why is this guy doing this? And the they're so sorry and all that, but they wouldn't move their diver. Meanwhile, we just picked up. It started raining. We said, forget it. We're done today. But the boat show was pretty interesting. I got to tell you something. It's supposedly one of the biggest or the biggest boat shows in the world. There's many components to this. There's the indoor area where they have just amazing fishing boats, you know, up to about 50 feet or so. And then there's the outdoor show and the accessory show. So it was kind of cool. We spent some time out there. There's about $3.1 billion worth of boats there. $3.1 billion of boats. And if you include all the accessories and all the other stuff, it's about $5 billion worth of goods that were there on the premises for the boat show. And supposedly, this is the time when many of the boat manufacturers get a chunk of the business. Something like 30 or 40% of some of the manufacturers' business comes from this particular boat show. And the revenues that are produced double what the revenues produced from a Super Bowl. So pretty impressive numbers overall. I was kind of impressed by the whole thing. I got to tell you, you go down the area where they have the in-water boat show, where they have all the boats in water. And I was lucky enough to notice a name on one of the very large ships there that I said, I think I know that name of that boat because I've seen across the canal in where I live, the boat with a similar name. And I think maybe the same owners. So I happened to mention something and I said, yeah, that's us and all that. And I said, can we get up? Tour? Sure. I'm like, great. Usually the tours are reserved for people who are going to either charter or buy, something in that line, et cetera. It has to be lined up well in advance. You don't often get these opportunities to take a look. So we took a look at this 145-foot brand new boat from a Chinese manufacturer, custom done, beautiful. And I asked the question I had to ask, you know, how much does it actually cost to charter this boat for a week? I said, for a week, you get the boat, you get the crew, nine crew, and sleeps 12, $135,000, but you have to supply everything else. All the food, I think the fuel as well, or you at least get charged for the fuel. And they take on a lot of fuel. So I said, well, we'll think about it. Anyway, that was kind of great. Now, I did go down to the T3 conference, which was sponsored by TradeStation and E-Trade and Ameritrade and a bunch of other people. Todd Harrison over at, I guess it's Todd Harrison Productions. I did have the opportunity to bump into some old friends and spend some time with them. Barry Ritholtz, who writes a great blog and also has a terrific podcast. Listened to a nice conference and seminar from Josh Brown, who works with Barry Ritholtz. Also, said hello to Mike Santoli from CNBC and Yahoo. I haven't talked to him in a while. He's been on the show a couple times in the past. And also a new friend, Dan Nathan from CNBC's Fast Money. Spent some time with him. Brief, but a little bit of time. And who else did I bump into? There's a couple other people I bumped into. Let's see. Barry's there's like three or four other people. Anyway, it was a good conference. There was, you know, it was down in Miami. There was a kind of a, it was for advisors in the financial industry, and it was also for retail investors. There were some interesting things done and talked about. Made some notes on that. And overall, a busy weekend. Well, we'll kind of get past that. I kind of blew maybe some time that we were going to spend on markets, but let's talk a little bit about things that are happening in the markets. Clearly, we have to talk about what happened last week when it comes to the jobs numbers and the economy, right? I mean, what a surprise. So that employers added 271,000 new jobs last month. Now, remember something. The 2 months prior to this, we saw a very disappointing overall jobs number, and it was to a point of shocking, and people were very concerned about what was happening. Even though there was some very good numbers from initial claims, and we saw a consistent number from ADP on Wednesday, in the neighborhood of about 170,000, there was some concern that what's going on here? There's a dislocation between what's happening in the initial claims, what's happening in other areas that we're seeing jobs reports come out of, and the official unemployment number. Well, a couple things. First of all, the unemployment rate is now officially 5%. We are seeing, of course, that the labor participation rate is the lowest that has been in decades. Now, forecasters were looking for about 182,000 jobs to be added, and we got this really strong number of 271,000. Now, that was kind of interesting. Wages rose from about 2.5%, it was. I think the number was 2.5% over the last 12 months. And that was one of the best improvements in over 6 years. That was kind of interesting. Where did the jobs come from? Well, a lot of them were service-related. Now, that's good news because the service sector, the service component of our economy is about 70 to 80% of the overall economy. We have absolutely and clearly shifted from a manufacturing base. Now, on this number, once that job number hit, even though the previous month was revised slightly lower to like 135,000 or so, so in the bag, we do have these last 2 months where we saw a total of about 280,000 jobs added. And this one that just was added of 271, wow, the dollar surged. I mean, just skyrocketed straight up. The yen came down hard. The euro came down hard. Dollar was up like 1.2% to like 99.20, getting towards that 100 mark on the Dixie, which is the composite, which compares the dollar against several other currencies in a basket. And anyway, point is, it's one of the highest levels we've seen in months. Markets were all over the place. Didn't know what to do with this number. Dropped the futures down initially, brought them up, brought them down throughout the day. There was a steady climb, I guess, with the idea that, well, the dollar's strong, we have a good employment number, and even if the Fed is going to increase, they keep talking about a very slow process of increases in the future. Now, I don't know exactly what that means because, again, if you would have just beamed down from Mars and you hadn't been here for 20 or 25 years, and you're an economist and you look at these numbers and you say, hey, you know what? We saw that the ISM non-manufacturing or the service index last week was 59.1. All right, yeah, the manufacturing number was 50.1, which is very close to contraction area. But still, we saw this good employment number. And generally speaking, the GDP at about 2, 2.5%, things are generally good. Where would we be on interest rates? And you would say, beam down after 25 years not knowing anything, I don't know, somewhere 3 or 4%. And I would say to you, no, we're at zero. And you would say, why is that? And I would say, I have no idea. Seems a little bit absurd to be at a zero interest rate bound when we have these kind of numbers. So the markets took that as kind of a further recognition and assumption that, you know what, the real probability is that we are going to see a rate hike in December. Fed's been talking about it. They've been marching out all of their various Fed governors to talk about this and confirm this, especially over the last week or so. So you know what? The probability is we're going to see a rate hike, minor as it may be. And what happened was that the dollar just skyrocketed. Now, on the heels of the dollar skyrocketing, we saw that commodities were pretty soft comparatively where they should have been. We saw that the was a big concern initially, especially with gold and oil. We saw that the material sector did not do very well. And we saw that the commodity-related stocks, actually some of the oil stocks did okay on the day, which was really interesting. So oil still has it looks like a bit of a base. Looks like there's an attempt at least to stabilize the price with all that's going on. We saw that, we know that over the last, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 months, that there's been a significant reduction in rig count throughout the U.S., even though we are seeing that they are still pumping ever so strongly in the Middle East. But end of day, I mean, there is a attempt to at least stabilize the price with the idea that there is more and more production coming offline. So one of the things we're going to be looking for, of course, and we talked about this with Frank Curzio, is the companies that are going to be looking at having prolonged trouble and them looking to cut their dividend and the potential for take significant rate downs. But so far, there's only a few of those that we've seen, some of the smaller players out there, and that's obviously rocked their stocks and really caused a lot of problems. But at the end of the week, we did see that the S&P 500 added about 1%, which is pretty amazing. It did settle in under the 2100 mark at 2099.20. This 2100 mark seems to be a bit of both a resistance and support level that is going to be reckoned with. Because right now, what we're seeing is that the P.E. ratio on the S&P 500 in total is about 18 times, and that's high up there compared to where things are on average. Now, it was interesting. At the T3 conference, there was an economist, or actually, yeah, I think it was an economist and an analyst in a panel. And these two guys were going back and forth talking about a variety of things. There was a third gentleman, also a money manager, who was pretty negative on the whole idea of what the Fed was doing, the real discussion about what's going on with the amount of debt they have, negative interest rates. The other two were pretty giddy about the whole thing. Yeah, it's great. We have negative interest rates are good. We see that they own all these bonds. That's good. And the Fed is just pumping money in. That's good. And it's never going to have a problem. But one of the things they did discuss in all of this was what's the really good level of PE in the current environment that we're in. If you look at the inverse of the 10-year yield, for example, well, you know, when rates are 5%, on average, maybe we should be, you could do an inversion of that. So it's about, on a 5, it'd be 20 PE. This is a very simple back of the napkin type of discussion. But if we see that rates are, let's say, at 2%, and you do an inversion of that, you know, well, maybe we could see a 30 or 40, maybe 50. Kind of ridiculous. But the fact is that low interest rates are very good for stocks. We do know that for a lot of different reasons. One, it helps borrowing and liquidity in the markets. Number two, we know that it really enhances the balance sheets of companies. Number three, we know that it really does a lot to affect the whole ability for companies to do buybacks. We know that. And not to mention the fact that there's also a higher yield on the S&P stocks or stocks themselves as compared to what you can get in bonds is very helpful, especially with the idea that, well, you know, volatility could be low for an extended period of time if, in fact, the Fed continues to have their hand underneath the markets. So that's a couple of things we gleaned from there. Anyway, the NASDAQ was up a bit, rose about 1.8% for the week. Dow gained about 1.4% for the week. That was kind of interesting. We do have a very limited amount of earnings coming out next week, but we do have some, economics, but we do have some earnings coming out next week that I think you're going to want to watch. You have in the beginning of the week, Priceline. Now, on Tuesday, we're going to have some of the home builders, D.R. Horton, Beazer Homes. Now, D.R. Horton had a couple of flub-ups, we'll call them, in terms of their earnings earlier in the year. They did post some better numbers, but I'd be watching that for a real good glimpse into what's happening with the homeowners, even though we know, generally speaking, from sales, new home sales, and their builders' confidence, things are good. There's also been some scuttlebutt and some discussion about maybe some of these home builders and some of the companies they own, like in the lending area, also in the title insurance area, and a few others in closing, that they may be, let's say, being a little bit strong-handed with their buyers, pushing them into using their particular companies. So there's been some discussion about that, and we'll see if something's going to happen there. Now, on Wednesday, we're going to see Dillard's, Macy's, see how it's going on in the retail space there. And we're also going to see a initial claims report on Thursday. And we'll also see Applied Materials, Cisco, El Pollo Loco, Fossil, Kohl's, Nordstrom's, and the new Planet Fitness that's going to be out. Friday, we're going to see October's retail sales numbers, the PPI number, and the initial number for November for the University of Michigan in terms of consumer sentiment. So we're going to see that. It's going to be very interesting to watch towards the end of the week. So the first part of the week is not going to be too exciting unless there is some overhang from the numbers we did see during the weekend on China. Did you see this? You know, China's talking about, things will get better and all that. Then they come out with, we're going to be at 7.2% GDP. That's our goal. Then we're going to be at 7. And now they're looking at a five-year plan of 6.5%. I don't know how they got to that from the idea that 7 was the number they were really shooting for forever. But now, 6.5%. But that's okay. If you look at the bright side, that's going to be all from domestic demand. We're going to be shifting over very quickly from an export-driven and manufacturing-driven type of economy into a domestically driven economy, and that's going to be really good for us, even though our GDP is going to drop. I have no idea how you make that into a good statement. No matter how you want to look at it, the output or GDP, no matter where it comes from, is a number that you look at, and it's not just simply where it came from. So in other words, you take the total amount of product that's produced by a country, and whether it's 6.5, 7, 8, 9, whether it comes from exports or it's domestically generated, it doesn't matter. The fact is that it's the GDP number. So don't let them sway you with this nonsense. Don't let anybody sway you with this. Now, what we did see, though, that was very concerning over the weekend, that we saw a significant drop in exports and imports. As a matter of fact, imports dropped like 16%. Since the last reading. Last reading was down 13%. So it was a bigger drop than we saw. So there's a lot of negative issues going on there, and it doesn't seem to be letting up at all. Now, one of the things we need to focus on with China is something that happened last week. I don't know if you saw what happened, but the central bank seemed to have cut out a little bit of information from, well, let me tell you how this played out. So the markets opened in China, I think it was on Wednesday or Thursday of last week. And boom, big rally. Why? Well, there's some discussion about the new exchange index, the ability for foreigners to invest more easily into their markets due to this special exchange they're creating and this cross-linked deal and all this. The problem is that news seemed to be clipped out of a speech or comment that was 5 months old. 5 months old. I talked about this in detail on DH Unplugged last week. The market rallied 5% to Shanghai, followed up with about 1.5% the next day also. Hang Seng didn't do so well. Did well, but not as well. The Hong Kong Exchange. So I'm not sure if in China they ever came out with the news that said it was 5 months old, or that's just information that we know here, because the news flows a little bit differently in China from where it does here. But that's a big concern. Now, of course, you have on the back of that the conversation that, well, the good news is that as exports are falling, as their economy is slowing down, as there is big concern about the GDP number, well, more stimulus. Call Mr. Stimulus, and he's going to come in and drop in all sorts of ideas and things that will help. The problem is that China has been stimulating their economy for months and months on end. They have been manipulating their currency. They have been doing all sorts of things to try to spur on demand, inclusive of all sorts of crazy things with their stock market, infrastructure development, lowering reserve rate requirements. I mean, the list goes on and on and on for months. A year. And their economy is still slowing. And the reason for that is very simple. The rest of the world is slowing as well. Again, in the U.S., we're seeing a 2.5% number. But you know what? At the end of the day, with the fact that we have such a strong dollar right now, you would think that we'd be doing a lot more importing from places like China. But, you know, over the years, what happened was a lot of their manufacturing base went somewhere else because it was cheaper. Vietnam, Philippines, Mexico. And what's happening with China right now is not that they want to necessarily, just because they do, change over to a more domestically driven economy. They're forced to do so because they're not getting the jobs anymore. They're not getting the manufacturing anymore. They're not getting the type of work that they were getting before. And because they have grown and they're maturing, there's a much higher level of demand that individuals have in terms of payments and their overall salary, etc. And hopefully that would lead to domestic demand, but it's just not doing it. Anyway, with China, the bottom line is that I think that there is a very high potential that if you look at the earnings of Chinese companies, you look at where the stock market just went into about a 20% increase over the from the bottom recently that we saw, that drop, it was like a 40% drop mid-year. And from that low point, up about 20%. Now, when you put into the earnings picture of what's gone on recently, you'll note that clearly earnings are going the wrong way. So what is pushing these markets up? Well, it's the government. They're, you know, investing. But unfortunately, we know what happens when all of a sudden there's a lot of margin that's been added, which has been done. When earnings slow down, which is happening. And when governments get involved, it gets very volatile. So we're still very negative on China overall and think that there is the real potential for the, really for what's going on in China, the realization of what's happening there on all fronts to be really felt here very shortly. Do I think that they're still in a bear market in China? Probably. Probably a bit of a bear market bounce here. And we'll see what happens. But I just really don't see China coming out of it because their earnings are just so poor. And the fact is that so much of this information and what's gone on is government induced that it seems to me that it's probably a very serious head fake here. Now, last week we talked about very briefly the sector rotation that was going on. And I didn't really get into the details of what was happening. But I thought what we'd do is we'd talk a little bit about what's happening with the sectors in terms of the global sectors and the domestic sectors and how the rotation is going and what's happening this year, the top and bottom areas throughout, and maybe what areas are looking good or bad. Let's start with the global picture. And these are all ETFs, so you may have some currencies that are affecting some of the returns. And what I mean by that is, and this is a really important concept to understand, we've talked about this in the past, that when you have an ETF, let's say, for example, I guess a good example would be EWJ. So, or even TUR, which is Turkey, the Turkish ETF, or EWZ, which is the Brazil ETF. What happens here is that you are susceptible to the moves in the underlying currency as well, because what you're doing is essentially buying an ETF and buying the stocks in that currency, right? So I shouldn't say in that currency, but buying the stocks in the U.S. currency. And what's happening is that you're getting clobbered potentially in Brazil because their currency has been going down substantially. Same thing in Turkey, same thing with Euro, for example, same thing with Japan. So as an example, if the Japanese currency, the yen, goes down 2% in a day, but their stock market goes up 2%, and you have the ETF of that stock market, you're going to get a 2% movement up in terms of the value of the underlying securities, but you may get a 2% drop due to the fact that the currency has moved lower. So you get a zero, big fat zero, because you have to balance both. So be very careful when you're dealing with this, because what may happen is that you have the right idea and things are going really well for the underlying securities, but what happens is that you have the currency situation. So what you may want to do is either find a situation where there's a hedging and you buy it in current currency or the R currency, or what you may want to do is hedge it out yourself, hedge the currency risk out yourself. Not in every case, but in some cases. In terms of what's going on this year, the worst performing major country ETF that I found is the Brazil, down 34% year to date. And again, that's a combination of what's happening with their stocks as well as what's happening with their currency. But remember something, there's a major oil exporter, Petrobras, that's involved in this particular ETF and with Brazil itself, not to mention all the scandals and all the governmental issues that are going on there. Brazil is down 34%, Turkey down 22%, Malaysia down 22%, Canada 18.5%. Now, some of that's due to the fact that the dollar is rising significantly, but again, you have to remember that Canada is a commodity-driven, well, not fully, but a big component of what they have is commodities. Same thing with Australia, New Zealand, to a lesser degree, to a large degree, Russia too, but a little bit different. Actually, Russia is the number one with up 15.5%. And I think that has to do with just how poorly they did last year with all the situations with the Ukrainian war, with the fact that oil was dropping off a cliff last year, and there's a bit of a rotation going in there. So again, I'm just going to run through these real quickly because I want to kind of talk to you about this. We're seeing that India is down 9%, emerging markets down 10%, Philippines down 8%, Taiwan down 5%, China, large cap, FXI, that's the Hong Kong, down 6.5%, Korea, South Korea down 1.9%. Let's see what else we got here. Japan up 10%. And the one of the ETFs that track the China, now not Hong Kong, I'm talking about China's CSI 300 is up about 2%. Now clearly the opportunities here are on things like Turkey, Brazil down so significantly, Singapore down 15%, maybe in Australia. That's if and only if there is a significant turn to the commodity structure and the commodity complex. If there's no turn, these aren't going to play. But I'll tell you something. If we do see any inkling of a move higher for the commodity complex, there's a very good chance that these can do very well. Month to date, Brazil is up 5%, Turkey up 4%, Malaysia up 1.2%, Canada still down. But if you look down the list here, really what we see the best is China, but we know what went on there with the manipulation of their markets by their government. But really the number one area is Brazil. I think it's very interesting when we see the overall settling out of oil prices recently. Now, in terms of the U.S., worst sector, you know it, energy. Down 11.5% for the year. Utilities are getting clobbered. And the reason for that is that there's a concern that the Fed's going to tighten. And as such, the yields that we're dealing with and those that look to the utilities as the place to go to replace yield are leaving. Same thing with REITs, by the way. They're kind of a little bit soft recently. Materials down 6.5%. The industrials, the S&P industrials are down 3.04%. The S&P 500 financial sector down marginally, actually even. Consumer staples up 1.4, telecom up 1.49, S&P up 2.19, healthcare up 5% still, home builders up 5.5, tech sector is up 7, and the consumer discretionary is winning the battle, up 12.85%. Now, I'll put these tables on thedisciplinedinvestor.com under the show notes for this particular episode, but I think what's really important out of all this is taking a look at the consumer discretionary ETF up 12.5% and wondering why is that? Is it because gas prices came down? Because consumers are making more money and wages are higher? Is it because the consumer's confidence is really doing well? What's going on there? Well, all the above are definitely possible, but probably it's because of the holdings. The number one holding inside the consumer discretionary ETF, wait for it, Amazon. Amazon's up 112% for this year to date. Now, if you look at where it is now, the consumer discretionary ETF holds about 10% of its entire holdings in Amazon. So if you think about that, if it's up 112% and holds about 10% now, probably started the year up about at about 5.5% of a holding of Amazon. Amazon has more than doubled for the year. So about close to about 6% of the total return of the XLY is due to Amazon. Other top holdings include things like Nike, McDonald's, Priceline, Home Depot, Disney. These are the ones that have been really providing a substantial amount of movement for this. Now, Disney's about 7.5%. Home Depot, 6.5%. Comcast, about 5%. So this list is very heavily weighted in the top 10 holdings. Where you see it's about close to about 60% of the total holdings of the portfolio are weighted for the top, the top several names. And as such, what's happening is that very similar to because it's a cap weighted index, of course, what's happening is that we're seeing the same thing in the markets, this S&P 500 as an example, where the biggest companies are providing a significant amount of movement to the upside and holding markets up very nicely due to the fact that these companies have really won. They won the game. Even with all of the things that are going on around the globe, the dollar moving higher, slow down on a global basis, what we're seeing is that the S&P 500 itself is doing well because the large caps are doing well. There's a movement towards safety and for those that are significantly keeping pace with earnings. Same thing in the NASDAQ 100. Why it actually hit a record was the largest stocks of the NASDAQ are the ones that are really doing well. The smaller caps like the Russell have yet to move much higher compared to where they were. Now, they did recoup a lot from their August 24th low, of course, but they're still not nearly as doing as well as the large caps overall. So I'll put these on there. I think what we want to look for right now is if there is further stabilization in the energy complex, clearly XLE is something you want to look for. I'm not a real big fan of the utilities, so we're going to leave that out. Same thing with materials, XLB and XLI. Would I say the opposite is true, that I look for weakness in the consumer discretionary to short it or the technology? Not really. Home builders, maybe. Healthcare, I think you really should start looking at the things like IBB or BIB. These are ETFs that are the pharmaceutical ETFs, NASDAQ Pharmaceutical Index. These are the areas that have been just absolutely obliterated with the recent goings on with Congress and Hillary Clinton and some of the pricing issues with Valiant and some of the shenanigans that they're pulling. And that's not over yet, by the way. The whole Valiant discussion about what's going on with their specialty pharma and what's happening with their pricing, with their overall process and mechanism for moving the drugs around to different providers to try to get the highest rate. The whole thing is going to have a massive investigation, and I just don't see it ending very well. I think it's a great thing to trade if you want to work it, but to hold it overnight, I got to tell you something, could be a very big concern because you never know what the news is going to be the next day before you get up. But in terms of the overall biotech index, I would start taking a look at that and put it on your overall watch list, because I think it's something that is, you know, it may not pass in terms of some of the scrutiny that's happening right now, but at the same time, I don't think that some of the worst fears that are being put into the sector right now may be realized. And as such, many of these companies who have done a great job at providing earnings growth year in and year out, and while that may be constrained somewhat with the inability for them to push the pricing of their drugs higher, if you look at the pricing of where they were, where they are now, I think they're still set at a very low bar to beat. And at the same time, they have probably been oversold to a level that's very concerning. Anyway, I'll put these particular tables on thedisciplinedinvestor.com on this show's episode notes. Okay, let's talk about a few different stocks, and then we'll close it up here. Some interesting things have been going on. First of all, Facebook, solid quarter. All metrics were really good. 8 billion daily views of videos. We're going to talk about this on DH Plug this week because I'm a little bit wondering, how do they count a video? Is it when you just scroll through it and it just plays a, you know, 1 second worth? Is that a play? Are they counting that? And if so, what does it mean? But other than that, we did see that all the metrics looked really good. We saw that revenue came in stronger. Mobile revenue and ad revenue came in really good. Monthly active users came in good. Quite opposite of what we saw with the Twitter results. At the same time, probably the only thing that you could throw in there as a concern is the significant increase in acquisition cost and expenses. That probably, if you wanted to pick something out of this, that was the thing that you had to pick. Now, Weight Watchers also beat earnings. Now, remember something. Weight Watchers recently moved up about 200% in a couple of days after Oprah Winfrey said that she was buying a big piece in the company, and she was now doing some spokesman type of commercials. And her, you know, if you look at the Weight Watchers site, she's all over it. She's lost a bunch of weight on it. Earnings came out, and the stock moved up another 40%. This is obviously on the back of massive amount of short covering and the fact that this Oprah effect is obviously already, I guess, somehow already catching on. Berkshire Hathaway came out with earnings. Things were good. They actually moved up very significantly due to their Heinz acquisition. But if you take out some of the interesting areas that were disclosed, they have about a $2 billion loss on IBM. But they're going to hold on to it. The whole IBM thing in Berkshire just doesn't fit. I just don't get it. You know, this is a company that is a serial disappointer in terms of revenues, doing a tremendous amount of financial engineering. Doesn't fit in with what Berkshire Hathaway stands for. And the whole thing doesn't make sense. Why they own this, I don't know. Maybe it's because, you know, Warren Buffett always says he doesn't understand technology. So maybe this was just something in the technology area that he could buy and it was big enough and, you know, IBM. So maybe it was that quadrant of his portfolio that he thought, maybe there's something I could buy. And Shake Shack did actually come out with earnings on Thursday night. They beat earnings nicely. Revenues also beat, came out with some nice guidance. But there's a couple of things that I picked up. One of the things that happened was a big short interest here. Shares moved up after the earnings results in the post-market. And pre-market, actually, things looked pretty good on Friday for them. But there's a couple of little gotchas in their report. One of them was that on the new stores that they're going to be putting out, the same store sales actually didn't look so impressive. They also had a discussion at the looking at 2016. They're going to have higher costs in their food, particularly in beef and in dairy. So once the shares opened, they started trailing down throughout most of the day and ended up about down 2%. by the close. So this is kind of buy the rumor, sell the news. What's going on here? We mentioned, I think previously, that I have a real negative opinion on the long term, very long term, on Shake Shack. A lot of volatility in between. But if you look at what they're doing and you look at the competition, you look at the fact that really the if you look at the valuation of this company compared to anybody in the same business, it's ridiculous. And I just don't see any way that they can grow into this valuation. I just don't get it. So while it is a new trend, this whole gourmet burger thing and this whole, you know, upscale, downscale type of dining thing, there is very low barriers to entry. Outside of New York, where people may not know where the origination of this and how this plays, I just don't see how this really becomes a major phenomena. It's a burger. Now, you could have said that for Chipotle, like, it's a taco, it's a burrito, but it's a bit different. It's very different, actually. Anyway, take a look at Shake Shack stock. We'll keep on looking at this. We'll see how the short squeezes work throughout the next few weeks and then come back and maybe reassess. But in our opinion right now, it does, again, looks like longer term, there is some inconsistencies in the ability for the company to really execute in a way that would make it valuation any more palatable. We're going to end it there. I want to thank you for joining us. Make sure to visit the disciplinedinvestor.com. Check out what's going on over there in terms of the site. Follow me on Twitter. Check out the charts and tables that we're going to put up there for this week. And if you need to reach me, of course, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. That's all for now. See you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.